This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello and welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. This is episode 24, another conversation with Frank Lance. We kind of wanted to talk about a lot more stuff than we were able to get to in our first episode last week. If you haven't listened to that episode, I would recommend checking that one out first. Probably we didn't really go back on too much of the same ground, but it's still probably worth listening to in that order. Now, I should mention that this episode is sort of going to be edited in a weird way. And basically what happened is I recorded a conversation with Frank, and for whatever reason, my voice on the recording just didn't come through right at all. So the quality was really bad and it was really quiet. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to just kind of say my things that I said again, sort of, and basically edit in Frank's answers. So that's going to be the format of the show. Just so you know, I'm not trying to do like sneaky, deceptive editing or anything. I'm going to say basically the same things that I said in the conversation, but I'm just going to say them again now. And it might sound a little bit disjointed, but it's because of that reason and not for some kind of nefarious reason of trying to make it sound better for me or anything like that. So with that said, today we had a conversation about two major topics, and we're just gonna dive right into them. So here we go. Frank's gonna start it off.
Why don't you start by saying what you think about execution, and I will tell you why you're wrong.
My position on execution is that it's not an ideal part of a strategy game because it doesn't, it's kind of this external resource that someone is bringing into the game, not really having to do with their decisions. So classic examples being StarCraft, Street Fighter, things like that, where you have this, strategy game, but then you can kind of just override the strategy game with enough micro or with enough, you know, good aim in an FPS or something like that. So it does have that problem of just bringing in an external resource that's not having to do with the actual strategy of the game. And then my other problem with it is that it's actually effectively random. Like, we can't control our muscles and stuff. There's a bit of a randomizer, you could say, in any time we make an input into a game. Like, we might just mess up, and it's not, you know, it's a lot like a dice roll. It's like we may have had the perfect strategy and like great idea, like we're playing well on the strategy game layer, but we just made an input error basically, and it makes it very easy for input errors to happen, so that you do something that you don't intend to do basically. And so those are my two major problems with execution.
Okay, so let me see if I can get you to like execution a little bit more than you do. I think there are two issues here. One is this idea of whether execution, when it exists in the context of a strategy game, is kind of a pure drag, or just, you know, has this cost that, you know, far outweighs whatever benefit it might have. And then the other related issue is the role that your attitude towards execution plays in the overall hierarchy wherein you place strategy games above games of skill in your system of thinking about how games and interactive systems provide value. And right, so these two things are separate but related.
Here, I just wanted to clarify that it's not that these systems, strategy games, are necessarily above other kinds of systems that may embrace execution, but that they're just different kinds of systems, that they're different.
Right, but it's not just that it's a different kind, it's a better kind, right? It's the one that you're more interested in. You think it's if you're interested in interactive systems, this is the kind that is giving you greater value.
I do think so, yeah.
Okay,
games,
yeah, all right.
Yeah, those kind of, yeah.
So I think, I think part of what's going on here is, I think you and I both value the power that games have to magnify and illuminate cognitive events, right? Cognitive experience, like the process of thinking and pursuing a plan and games put that under a microscope and allow us to to kind of simultaneously dive very deeply into the process of using our brains to accomplish a goal, while at the same time kind of stepping back and getting like insight into how that works. But I think in your case, you have a bias towards the, what I would call a bias towards the cerebral, right? There's a sense in which there is a certain kind of cognitive behavior that you are giving, you know, a precedence, which is, you know, the type of cognitive behavior that is explicit, that is conscious, deliberate, and as opposed to the type of cognitive behavior that is less present to our kind of conscious awareness. And I just think that they're, not only are they both interesting, that they are, like, one of the most interesting things about them is the way that when human thought and behavior is placed under the microscope of a game, you have to sort of question some of your assumptions about these two categories, right? About the difference between thought and action, right? These are very obvious categories. They make a lot of sense in the normal world that we live in. There are things that are decisions, and then there are things that are actions. But one of the great things about games is that it's not the normal world, right? It's this weird particle accelerator of human thought and behavior by which we get to like unpack these things that are common assumptions, and they turn out to be much more complicated and interesting than we thought. So that I think is, you know, is a fascinating thing that has a lot of value. That part of the value that games can provide as interactive systems is, you know, not just, you know, framing this very kind of deliberate, conscious, aware, discrete decision making and putting that kind of on a pedestal, Sid Meier style, right? But also, you know, exploding the whole range of human thought and behavior. So if you think about what goes into throwing a pitch in baseball, it is so fascinating, right? It's about physics, right? It's about understanding the rules of the world, and it taps into mechanisms in the brain, modules in the brain, which are these evolved modules for doing the complex calculus that is involved in tracking moving objects and understanding how they're going to behave, it spans the entire range from the very conscious and deliberate decision of what kind of pitch I'm going to throw, which is a strategic decision of the highest order of the kind of, you know, Bergunzian style, like conscious, deliberate. I'm fully aware that I'm deciding which kind of pitch, you know, that I want to throw, down, you know, through these kinds of all the little the sort of cascading micro choices that happen that are liminal, that are in between conscious and subconscious of when I'm going to like lean back and get ready to pitch. And I don't know how pitching works. I've never pitched a baseball, but you know, and I'm going to like shift my weight and I'm consciously thinking, oh yeah, remember what my pitching coach said, I need to like really, you know, shift my weight more. So I'm going to consciously shift my weight. Meanwhile, they're all, you know, all I'm engaging with all these mechanisms that are not, you know, that I'm not completely in charge of or consciously aware of, but they're all fully engaged and And at a certain point, you know, it's drilling all the way down into these things that I have no awareness of and no control over. And I am surfing across this entire range, right? And moreover, in addition to the thing that happens when I'm throwing the ball, there's also all the stuff that happens when I'm training, like when I'm engaged in the practice of being a great baseball pitcher. I have to think about all of these things. And in some cases, I'm making conscious, deliberate choices to program my brain with subconscious, automatic responses through repetition and training. And I might have a conscious kind of strategic decision about how to do that. You know, like what's the best way to change my instinctual and subconscious behavior, you know, given these other factors. So the whole thing is like unbelievably fascinating and deep and beautiful and meaningful. And we don't gain a lot by just slicing that off and saying, no, we just are interested in this, in the parts where I'm deciding which, you know, where to move my knight.
Sure.
Right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's my first volley at trying to defend this stuff.
So here I made the point that even though it's interesting that you don't necessarily put something into a strategy game just because it's interesting, there may be things that are interesting that are not necessarily appropriate for a strategy game. So I asked here whether there was anything that Frank thinks is interesting, but that wouldn't necessarily belong in a strategy game, wouldn't be appropriate for a strategy game.
Give me an example. What, like baking a cake? Like the David Sirlin example of, I'm going to like make a decision in this strategy game that I'm going to go bake a cake. Have you heard him give this example? And then I'm going to come back and depending on how well I made the cake, we're going to resolve this decision I made. To a certain degree, this is a matter of definition though. You're just saying these things don't belong in a strategy game, but it's because we've defined strategy games to not include them. So therefore, by definition, they don't belong.
It's, yes, by definition.
As opposed to being like, oh, they're not a good, like, that's why there's this other important issue, which is this kind of evaluative, you know, judgment about types of games and whether, so there's chess boxing, you know, so in some ways, boxing and chess are these two extremes of this range of these kinds of games. But then there's chess boxing. There's this, which is in some ways like a joke, but in other ways like not a joke. Like it's a serious.
Tell us what's chess boxing.
Oh, so chess boxing is a kind of game that is, sort of semi-popular thing that people do. I think mostly in kind of Eastern Europe, and you box one round, you have a round of boxing, and then you have 5 minutes of chess, and then you go back and you have another round of boxing, and you have another 5 minutes of chess. And the loser is the first person to get knocked out or checkmated. And, on the one hand, it's absurd. It's sort of like a thought experiment, you know, come to life, which is great. But it's a real thing that real people do. And part of what I think it illuminates is the fact that, you know, we have these sort of cliches about different personality types and different kinds of people and who's good at chess and who's good at boxing. But under the hood, there is a sense in which people who are good at chess are also good at boxing. You know, they're not as different as you might think, right? We have this kind of Cartesian dualism that's built into our perception of. And it, again, it makes sense. Obviously, it's intuitively true that there's a difference between thought and action. But then they get, you know, embodied by these caricatures in our head. We have the Poindexter who plays chess, and the big hulking, monster that boxes. He's just like all. But it's just not true. Like under the hood. Those things are not as different as you might think. There's a beautiful book called The Art of Learning by Josh Weitzkin. I don't know if you've ever read it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good book. And so this is a guy that was a chess prodigy, and then he kind of like burned out on chess, and he started to study Tai Chi to recenter himself and to kind of like, and then he started like getting better and better Tai Chi, and then pretty soon he was like doing competitive Tai Chi, like push hands, which is the competitive form of Tai Chi. And then all of a sudden he was like in the world, you know, championship of push hands. And now he's like back at the very top of this competitive form, because under the hood, those things are not as different as they look, right? They look like these entirely different things, but they're not. They're both beautiful expressions of the human ability to think and act.
At this point, I brought up that there may be one way in which Frank and I tend to talk past each other. And there's different theorist people who I, you know, talk past each other for various reasons. But I've noticed that I think with Frank, it tends to be a lot of the times I'm trying to come up with guidelines for better design, for designers to actually act upon. Whereas Frank is maybe sort of more looking from a more distant view in a more sociological kind of cultural way, kind of appreciating whatever's there, kind of. So I sort of made that point, and here's what Frank said.
I don't think those are that different, though. I mean, I'm interested in games. I'm interested in making good games. I'm interested in understanding games on a deep level. I'm interested in illuminating what makes games beautiful and meaningful and interesting, and getting more of that in the world. I think it's similar.
So I made the point that with chess boxing, I have no problem saying that chess boxing is probably a bad idea. Like, that is not at all ideal game design, is to just sort of slap two systems together like that. Whereas I think that Frank kind of does have a problem with making a guideline like that. So I made that point.
Okay, but like that's okay. So that it's funny because you have that insight, and it's clearly that's like, oh, that's an insight into the game. But then how is that the end of the story? Aren't you interested in like why this game doesn't collapse under that? Like why isn't that a fatal flaw?
So here I just asked, what's the definition of a fatal flaw? I mean, I don't think that chess boxing is incredibly popular as it is. How would we call it? Like, at what point would we have said that it was dead from a fatal flaw? You know, like, I don't think it's incredibly popular, and I'm not sure by what metric it succeeds. I also mentioned that that chess boxing, to whatever extent it's successful, it's relying on the popularity and cultural strength of boxing and of chess, both of which are huge. So that was my counterpoint there. Frank also asked if I was curious about it, and I am curious about it. Like, I would definitely watch a documentary about it or read about it, but that doesn't mean that I have to, you know, curious about something doesn't mean that I can't say, as a general rule, as a guideline, this is not a good practice for game design.
Right. But again, I think that that's a theory about how this is likely to play out. And the reality sometimes doesn't match the model, right? So there, you know, I understand in theory, like, Serlin's, you know, prohibition against Kara throws, right? Like, you understand that. They're like a thing that's technically, in a fighting game, a thing that's technically very difficult to pull off.
Okay.
And 100% advantageous all of the time.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah,
okay?
Parries. So,
right, so this is a very difficult technical thing to pull off, and 100% advantageous. So there's no question about whether you should try to pull it off. You should always, if you can, you should be able to pull it, right? So I understand in theory why that's bad, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that in practice, right, it creates this weird surface in the game. It's this weird ledge in the game that, you know, and Serlin's point, I think, is well taken. Was like, no game designer would ever put that in their game on purpose, right? It's a weird artifact that's the result of like some technical, it's like, but it's a it's like games are, you know, games are clearly designed, but in some ways they're also found. They're designed objects that are also a little bit like found objects. So they're like a skate park, right? They're like, I'm going to design this skate park, but then they're also, they're like these weird crevices and ledges and things and things that you didn't intend in the skate park. And then people are like doing tricks, you know, off the edges of these things. And that's kind of what Kara throws are like, right? Because even though they don't make sense from a, you know, strategic design perspective of being an interesting thing, and you can make all kinds of arguments about why they're not good, they open up a little space in which there are kind of some surprising and surprisingly interesting decisions and strategic levels that accrue around them, right? Because now all of a sudden they like, so for example, they are a thing that in, when I'm training, you know, which is an interesting part of a fighting game, it's not just the resources that I'm using inside the game, but the resources that I'm using as a practitioner of this game to get better, right? It's sort of like the meta algorithm that I'm using to hone my the algorithm that I use inside the game, right? And I think this is true in a lot of cases in games where it's not just it's not the solution. It's like I'm searching through, you know, problem space to find a solution, and it's not the solution that's interesting. It's the search. It's there are all of these different strategies. There's only one strategy in chess to actually win, right? What's really going on in chess is all the different strategies for searching, right? You know, I can study openings, I can memorize openings, I can work on the kind of brute force of my the calculation engine, I can work on my evaluation functions, I can, you know, study famous games, I can, you know, all of these different, like these are all strategies for searching. They're meta strategies, right? And so Kara throws open up a kind of like little tiny space for meta strategies in training. Now all of a sudden, here's a little thing that I can decide whether or not to get good at. And once I do, I have access to some hidden information. So now I've added hidden information into the game because now I know how good I am at these and you don't. And then on top of that, there's all the kind of like obvious and kind of fundamental value of just the cognitive, you know, operation of executing a difficult task under pressure, right? So those things I think have values that are not as obvious as the values of a like a super cleverly balanced system, but I think that there are values there nonetheless, right? And I think that they're maybe underappreciated.
To that I replied, really underappreciated? Because I feel like most games, most people, most game players, all have, there's lots of execution in many popular games, and very few people really question it.
Yeah, I guess maybe I just meant underappreciated by you.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, and David Sirland, right? Underappreciated by people who bother to really think deeply about these issues.
So at this point, I brought up that Frank mentioned how these things like Kara throws and other maybe almost exploit level things are surprising and kind of exciting about video games. And that's something that we also talked about with the randomness stuff, is how sometimes randomness is like, it's this exciting aspect of these video games. And I think that the real reason for that is maybe because our video games just aren't that exciting very much. Like when they break is actually the best part of them right now, because we don't know what we're doing. We're not making very good things. And so, you know, we make these systems that people, like any normal healthy adult looks at them and pretty much immediately understands everything that system is capable of. So when something is like, the only time we get any real emergent things is when there's something that's kind of broken or sort of weird or, you know, doesn't really belong. And so, yeah, those kind of like bad game design guideline things right now seem like the most interesting things, because we're not embracing the form. Like, that's kind of what I went on about here.
If they're the most interesting things about our system, why aren't we deeply inspired by them? If they're so interesting,
They're
more interesting than the things that we're sort of deliberately setting up. Why are we then doubling down on this kind of like deliberate? Why aren't we going out and like drawing more inspiration from these kind of, you know, organic?
Here, I just wanted to mention that I come from a world of playing many execution-heavy games. I played FPSs my whole life. I played RTSs. I played fighting games, racing games, just you name it. That was what I grew up on, and I was extremely intensely into for the first 25, almost 30 years of my life. And so it's not that I don't understand the value and appreciate the value of these execution-heavy games. It's that I think that we can do a lot better. And while, you know, I think I do actually appreciate and understand the value of these competition heavy games, I think that other people don't understand and appreciate the costs of implementing them. So that's something that was my main point here.
But what do you think of Counter-Strike? Are you at all paying attention to Counter-Strike Go? I mean, games, competitive games are these weird little experiments in problem solving under conditions of sort of, you know, constrained computational power, right? We're incapable of these big problems. They're actually quite small compared to the wicked problems of the world, because they're like these little artificial problems that we design in a sense to be solved or to be almost solvable. But they're still like enormously bigger than we can, you know, even imagine solving. And so then we sort of fling ourselves at them, we with all of our resources, you know, and try to like, and there's this, I mean, that's the, you know, there's this strange beauty and meaning that comes up, you know, these, watching a human kind of encounter this huge problem and just like dive deeper and deeper into it. And it kind of like reveals all of these interesting things about human problem solving, and to me the aspects of that include both system one and system two thinking are fascinating and beautiful and meaningful. So I don't know if you know, do you know Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Kahneman?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there's like these different, you know, so like something like Counter-Strike Go or, you know, anything that involves execution, and also kind of high level strategy, is this weird blend of the two kind of primary modes of thought that define human behavior, you know, cognitive behavior. The system one, thinking, which is sort of instantaneous and instinctual and is where we make our snap judgments and how we sort of like normally interact with the world. And system two thinking is where we stop and sort of consciously and deliberately kind of consider our options and make a choice. And you know, system two is much more present to us. We're more aware of it, and it obviously is something that we, you know, we kind of celebrate, and because it's, you know, we kind of we want to have more of that kind of considered and rational behavior in our lives, but it's less than half the story of how we actually operate in the world, and I think there's I wonder even where we think we're in full system two territory, I even wonder if it's the case, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, when sure. You can get into like a free will.
Or even without getting in, wandering to that, you know, when you drill down to the kind of decision that you find interesting in a strategy game of, you know, of the classic type that you want to have more of, like, what's actually going on there? Like, you've talked about the way things, if you're not careful, that the decisions, you know, or the a strategy game can turn into just a calculation contest, right? But like, I'm curious about, I'm curious about what is actually the alternative to a calculation. Like, what is the form of decision making that you think is interesting, and what does it actually look like when it's not calculation?
Here I said that it's really just analysis is the thing, not calculation. And it's also what David Deutsch has put as the most important aspect of decision making is the creation of new options.
Right. Isn't that a point for me, though?
I don't think so. I mean, not for this discussion anyway, because you're talking about...
Here I went on a big rant about how making an execution-heavy game is not in your interest if you want to create those kind of like, aha, you know, creative, deep, interesting insight moments. Maybe if you have a tenth of a second to make a decision, you can come up with some crazy, weird, creative solution. But I would say that most of the time you're operating on reflex and on muscle memory and just what your body is trained to do, kind of a biological response in those situations. And so I think that as a design guideline, it would make sense to give the player a little bit of time at least to make their decisions to facilitate them thinking a little more deeply and then coming up with like a little bit more of an interesting answer to the question rather than just, you know, if somebody asks you like, what's 7+4? You know, like you just like, oh, I don't know. It's like very hard to answer questions like very quickly. You say something, it's usually the answer is you totally screw up and just say something stupid, or you put in just the right answer barely. There's not a lot of time to come up with like an insightful answer when you're really rushed. And so that was my main point here. Also, just so it's not confusing, I had mentioned something about employing a strategy that no one's seen before. And here's Frank's response.
What's a strategy that no one's thought of before?
A strategy that no one's thought of?
Yeah, you just thought like that's the thing that we're looking for. It's like a strategy that no one's thought of before. But like what is that? I mean it's like choose the best move. I mean it's what are you talking, like attack at night?
Well,
like attack where the person isn't looking? It's like
So I explained that you know, in a normal strategy game situation, you may have two or three like normal basic options that are, you know, the obvious possible choices. And then you might be like, wait a second, could I do this? And it's this completely weird thing. And you're like discovering a new pattern in the system. In a really deep system, this should be possible. This is not possible in most video games and even most board games. But in a ideal game design system, it would be possible to come up with like new things that maybe no one has seen before, but that are just really kind of unexplored avenues of the possibility space.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think we're kind of on the same page about this, but I think I maybe disagree with the conditions under which that occurs. I think that it's In every case, like what we're talking about is problem solving under conditions of kind of limited computational capacity, and that's the case whether you have an hour to think about something or a tenth of a second, right? Or a year, right? It occurs. Why not, right? I mean, I think there's as much. Like delightful surprise and creation of new knowledge in the year-long process of pioneering a new route in a speed run of Half-Life 2, right? And slowly as a group of people slowly like discovering new ways through this system, and I think that generates new understanding and new explanations and new knowledge. And I think it's also it's something that happens in a fraction of a second when you are Julius Erving and you are, you know, under, and you find yourself under the basket and you're all of a sudden in a tangle of limbs that you've never seen before, and you have to like do this lightning fast calculation that draws from all of the deep modules of how human bodies move and how physics works and your spatial awareness and everything else, and it just like clicks and you kind of invent this new ballet move on the fly, and you're just like, it's this like incredible like new thing of beauty. And it also happens in the kind of like 10-minute window where Kasparov is choosing, you know, a chess move, you know, when he's playing Karpov. But I think you're just picking the 10-minute version and saying that's the one I'm interested in, you know, more than these others, which is fine. But I don't think I mean that's just a preference. I don't think that it's backed up by any kind of concrete difference.
Here I just made the point that the decisions that you can make in a tenth of a second are going to necessarily be shallower than one that you can really take some time to think about. And I kind of went on about that a little bit, but I think you get the point.
So why do you like the 10-minute version instead of the year-long version?
I never made any...
Well, why don't you... Thing. Why don't you... Do you prefer correspondence chess to regular chess? Or do you... I mean...
I just have practical reasons for why I would prefer 10-minute chess to correspondence, you know, 10-year chess or whatever, 10-month chess.
But you should prefer it. I mean, if you have more thought and time you put into a decision, the more interesting it is, you should prefer these very, very slow, very long games. And I don't see that. I don't see evidence of that.
I admitted that in principle, yes, a year-long, one-year-per-decision system would actually result in more interesting decisions. There's a lot of practical issues, though. I mean, you would be able to only play like one match your whole life, probably. And so that's kind of a very slow feedback loop for the system. And also, it just not a lot of systems can really hold up to that much scrutiny. So I think that most games really need to be have some kind of timer. I think all games need to have a timer, but really a more practical timer is probably something like the lengths that games are now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, so let's maybe we should move on to players.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so do you want to set this one up?
So yeah, the second topic that we talked about was whether the default state of a strategy game, which historically has always, I think, been thought of primarily as two players. There are multiplayer games. There are team games. There are solitaire games. But the default way for people to think about strategy games has always been, I think, as a two-player game, like chess. But my new proposal is that really the default method for designing strategy games should be one player. And there are reasons for why that is. And I'm going to write a big article about this soon, but the short answer is there's random player. If you assume that you can't read an opponent and that you can't, which I do, I believe that you can't really read an opponent and that opponent input is basically random. Like you may have some statistical analysis idea of what a player may do, but for the most part, it's random, like a dice roll or a card draw. You may have some statistics on it, but you know, it's still like a random input. So since it's random, though, the problem is human beings are really weird and unpredictable, and they may not follow certain patterns that you want them to follow to make the game the ideal for the other player. So what's great about computers and single player games is that we can create algorithms and special rules to make sure that the random information being presented into the game is always the ideal information for the system at play. So that was my big... That's basically the argument of for why games should inherently be by default be single player.
Yeah, so I guess the fundamental defense of other humans in games is that that traditionally and probably for good reason the experience of playing a competitive game is a kind of intimate social interaction with another person, right? That there is an intense engagement with another human mind, and in a strategy game that involves a series of unfolding problems that you are making for each other. So I'm not only searching through problem space to find a solution to a problem, I'm doing it in a way that kind of generates the most difficult problem for my opponent and vice versa. And so we are, you know, summoning all of our faculties to generate in real time a kind of circular, interacting set of recursive problems that are spiraling up into, you know, more and more kind of beautiful intensity. I think that it seems to me like you're kind of transferring that intimate social connection to the relationship between the player and the designer.
I actually don't word it that way. I really tend to hate that kind of wording. I find those kind of things confusing and unnecessary and sort of just strange. The way I would say it is we're discarding that good value. That is indeed a good value, but we have to discard it in order to get something even better. This is something that we have to do all the time. I'm sure there are things about horse and buggy or some older forms of medicine that were really kind of cool. There was like some good things about these older technologies. Writing letters. There's cool things about writing letters. But you know what? It's kind of better that we can send emails now. It was worth losing those cool things. And I think that this is one of those situations where, yes, we'd be losing this thing, but we'd be getting so much more in exchange.
But like, what is the thing that we're getting? What is the thing we're getting in exchange?
And so here I just had to kind of say that, you know, if you assume that designing a strategy game is like a really, really, really hard thing that's really, really difficult, then even a small advantage of giving the designer full control over what kinds of things are going to be coming into the game, then that small advantage may be what makes it actually really work. So basically, I'm just trying to say, yeah, it might seem like a small advantage, but given how hard it is to design a system like this, it actually might become a large advantage and be worth it.
Okay, let me attack this from a different angle. I just thought of something that might get you. When you design a two-player game, you're actually designing a two-player strategy game like chess is kind of like just a large puzzle. And it's a puzzle that we are collectively trying to solve. So even though each instance of a game of chess is a competition between two people, in some ways it's a collaborative process by which we are, through this push and pull of move and counter move, we are exploring the depths of how this system operates and discovering truths about it. If you were going to make that for one person, it would ideally need to be a smaller problem. It's going to be inherently less interesting because it's not designed for this, you know, it's like if you were designing a bouldering problem in a rock climbing gym and you had one that was designed for two people, it's going to allow for much more complicated and difficult and interesting kind of movements than the one that you've designed for one person.
I asked, does this also apply then to 3 and 4 player games and so on?
Maybe there's a world of higher level play that this is maybe a place where I get to kind of put on my futurist hat and say, because I think that's maybe a kind of underexplored and underutilized area of game design, like truly multiplayer games, right? Games that utilize the collaborative and competitive interactions of multiple players to explore and understand fully. So I think that one of the things that's beautiful about League of Legends is its scale, that it is, you know, that is these 10 minds operating in conjunction, that there is something kind of particularly interesting about that. And maybe in some ways it's more interesting than chess, partly because of it's opened up. It's like a much larger problem space, and therefore the kinds of thinking that gets done both by these individuals as individuals, but even more importantly in this kind of collective process of shared decision making, that is just truly kind of more interesting and meaningful and beautiful in this kind of idealized strategy game sense that you're talking about.
So another thing I brought up here was just the fact that making a game multiplayer really makes it sort of seem like it works. And I'm just kind of skeptical of things that make game design really easy. Like, to me, that sends a signal that probably there's something fuzzy going on there.
I think these are things to pay attention to for sure. Like, I think that it's possible to take a system that's not very interesting and just drop another person in it and be like, wow, look at my game. People are having fun. It's like, well, people will have fun in a room.
Yeah, exactly.
You could just make a room. And so there is this sense in which, but I think most good game designers are aware of this. I mean, I do think that most good game designers feel that sense of cheating. It's one of the, I mean, it's not one of the reasons that video games are single player, because that's complicated. But I do think that, there are a lot of video game designers who just assume that the sort of holy grail of game design is a single player system. I think, you know, right? Don't you think that there's like a lot of progressive, interesting game designers? I don't know, people like Clint Hawking or someone, for whom like it's just goes without saying that the thing he's interested in is a deep system that the player is engaged with. And I think in his case, it has a lot to do with kind of the representational layers. It's not just, but he's also interested in the kind of the underlying properties of the system and how it allows for creative problem solving and, you know, the generation of new ideas and knowledge and all the ways that you like. And I think he's just totally on board that project in a way that is similar to what you're describing. And I think that's not that uncommon for a certain, like, Sid Meier, you know, I think is ultimately more interested in I don't think, you know what I mean? I don't think he's that interested in head-to-head competition.
Yeah, multiplayer, right? In all of his games tends to be kind of like tacked on,
right? He's like on board this, you know, your train of thought. Whereas I'm not as sure that I am, you know what I mean? I think, again, I mean, my basic refrain is just that things are more complicated than they look, right? That that it's, while you might have an insight that says, oh, well, you know, ideally this would be like this, and my instinct is to always stop and be a little bit skeptical of that. Okay, well, maybe that's true, maybe not. We can't be so certain. Let's, you know, let's just keep trying different things. What was the David Deutsch quote that you tweeted earlier?
Now I can get the quote exactly. It was from David Deutsch's book, The Beginning of Infinity, which is an awesome book, and Frank and I both have read it recently. But the quote is, the most important part of decision-making is the creation of new options.
Yes, exactly, right? Let's keep our options open.
Oh, sure.
Right? Let's not lock in. Let's not decide that we know for sure how things should.
And here, this is a little bit unfair to Frank, for me to make this comment here, but, I said at this point in the conversation, who's saying that? Like, who's saying that? And Frank responded.
That's just my refrain, right? So,
And so, yeah, I just wanted to interject here because I often say to Frank that I get the impression that he is anti-theory, and he's always like, no, it's not that. It's just, I'm anti your theory. That's what he says. But this is the kind of thing right here where he just says that's for some reason, even though no one's saying otherwise, that makes me feel like he doesn't really like, you know, doesn't really want anyone to make positive statements or, you know, at all. So I just wanted to interject that. And, you know, obviously, Frank, feel free to rip me a new one in the comments after you hear this. Anyway, back to the conversation.
I think human thought is inherently social, right? I think the brain evolved in the context of other brains, right? The brain did not evolve in a tank, and no problem is interesting in a vacuum. problems and problem solving is interesting in the ways that in which it resonates with the rest of the universe and resonates with our world. And I think that that thinking is more social than we realize. I think we have a kind of idealized, abstract vision of thinking as occurring in a kind of vacuum of reason, when in fact it's always kind of deeply, messily social. And so one of the things I like about competitive games that have other humans in them is that is the way they resonate with the world, you know, of how brain works.
Here I just propose sort of offhandedly the idea of playing a single player game by committee. So a bunch of players are sitting around and deciding what to do in a single player game.
Yeah, but that's terrible. So this might be a good transition into my prohibition. So we've been talking about all the things hate, and it's like I'm this flower child of like, no, all games are good. Basketball's great. Chess is great, you know. When in reality, I'm as much of a cynical, you know, hard snob as you are. So I think most collaborative games are not great. And I think so first of all, I think Hanabi is great. I think Hanabi is a masterpiece. I think it's a small masterpiece, one of the great games of the past, you know, 5 or maybe even 10 years. It's this beautiful little collaborative game that is just such a perfect little, but it's like a koan, right? It's like a haiku. It's not like a big sprawling game. It's very, very small but it's very beautiful. But in general, I think people have this naive attraction to collaborative games that is like nails on a chalkboard for me, because they assume that they're more accessible and that they're more friendly, and they also assume that they sort of encourage values of cooperation and friendliness and empathy, and in fact none of that is true. Like, collaborative games, first of all, tend to be more hardcore, because they have to be harder problems because you have a committee that's there to solve them. So you have this harder core thing. They're less friendly because when I make a mistake in a competitive game, I'm helping everyone else. Everyone else is happy. When I make a mistake in a cooperative game, I'm hurting everyone else. I mean, imagine a 2-hour game of Pandemic, where in the final move, when we're about to win, we're all covered in sweat and it's been like 2 hours of grueling problem solving, and I just play the wrong card or I go to the wrong thing and I ruin the game for everybody. I feel miserable. Everyone hates me. So it's actually it leads to kind of more negative feelings, and then it also collapses into chairmanship, right? It collapses into a captain and dictating to everyone else what to do.
Here we had a little bit of an aside about Pandemic, but it's not really important, so I edited it out.
Here's what I said. So those are the reasons. I like collaborative games. I think collaborative games are cool. But I just think that it drives me crazy that people who don't really understand games and don't think about games have this tendency to overvalue collaborative games for all these reasons, and they're just mistaken about the results, right, of how it's going to work. Like, I think for League of Legends, for example, the reason that the League of Legends' community is so toxic is because the game is collaborative.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's such a surprising, unexpected, you know, thing, but...
Here I just mentioned that one of the reasons that it's more collaborative than something like Counter-Strike or TF2 is, now I was back in the day a pretty advanced TF2 player, to the point where, you know, on pub servers or whatever, the strategy game element of it is completely overridden by if I can just, you know, land pipe bombs or rockets into people's faces effectively. I can just kill half the other team and then our strategy doesn't really matter. And so I was thinking that hopefully, you know, Frank could use his example as a way to see how back to my execution example, it's not ideal when like something from sort of outside the strategy game just comes in and sweeps and crushes the strategy game element of it, or vice versa for that matter. So you don't want a system to be inherently fighting itself.
Another prohibition that I would like to claim is three-player games. So this is something that I see students often do, especially if they're a team of three people working on a game. They're like, "Oh, we designed a three-player game," and it's because they just didn't. It's because there are three of them, and they're like, just designed a game for three people. But I tend to kind of like overreact a little bit to this, and I will sometimes. For a long time, it just, you know, it didn't bother me at all. And then over time, having kind of played a lot of these games and thought about this a lot, it now bothers me a lot more. Because I think that the mostly it is the kingmaking problem, basically, right? But the kingmaking problem is so much bigger and more pervasive than you might think. It's not just a little problem that can be solved. I mean, I think it's useful to look and realize that there are no, by and large, there are no serious competitive three-player games, yeah. Or really multiplayer games, like three or four, like free-for-all style games. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? And it is this issue of having a game where my actions, you know, I get in. It's easy to get into a situation where my actions are not determining, are not meaningfully contributing to the way the game is unfolding.
On this point, I just agree completely with no objections whatsoever.
Yeah. So I almost want to say, hey, there aren't any three-player games. I mean, there are like fun party games that are three-player, but there aren't any really like serious, deep, competitive three-player. Okay. And then finally, my final one is. It's sort of a two-parter, but it's basically long games with politics. I think a little bit of politics goes a long way. I think a tiny drop of politics in an ocean of a game will quickly just spread to kind of tint the entire ocean. So politics is, you know, games that allow for alliances, secret alliances, backstabbing, that kind of thing.
I asked, is this distinct from the kingmaking problem?
You know, I guess it. Now that I think about it, I guess that it really isn't. But I would say that there is a certain flavor of games like kind of Neptune's Pride or Subterfuge, which fall into this category of the very long, very complex. Strategy game that also allows for politics, and I think that I just have like a special adverse reaction to that, because there is this there's a sense in which, okay, we have this really complicated system that you're asking people to like understand all the intricate ways that it that your actions play out, and you have limited resources and these different mechanisms that overlap, and so you've got all the complexities of like doing a deep dive in this complex strategic system, and then like 2 days later it turns, you know, the outcome of the game is determined by the fact that these other two people just had an alliance the whole time.
Yeah.
Right? It's just sort of like, what, it just seems so pretend, like why, like, I mean, you can imagine an idealized version of this in which these things are working together to lead to a really interesting situation where I have to both use my, all my wits and all my kind of, you know, my deep understanding of the system. And at the same time, I have to do this like dance with these social, you know, these other social agents where we're like balancing our different needs and our different level. And in that sense, it's sort of like, I think you can imagine a fantasy version in which the politics and the mechanics work together like skill and strategy work together in Counter-Strike. But the difference...
Like you say, they work together.
Exactly, exactly. But here's the difference. They actually do work together in Counter-Strike. Like, Counter-Strike Go is just, like, a beautiful game by... Like, it's just obviously beautiful, right? That's why there are, like, millions and millions of people watching it, you know, admiring it, like digging it on a deep level and exploring it and performing it at a really high level and producing all these amazing moments and all these beautiful things that people are getting value out of and discussing and talking about, like, whereas these other games, I just don't,
yeah.
Right? So that's the difference.
Okay, so-
Here I just went on again about how you don't want one part of your system to be just completely overriding another part of your system, using the same kind of examples from execution and from what we're talking about now.
Right, but to me, the difference is really instructive. Like, they're both bad in theory, but one of them is bad in practice, and the other one turns out not to be.
I asked, is it just because Counter-Strike is popular that he's saying this?
No, it's not because it's not just because it's popular, because it is beautiful, it is deep, it is meaningful, it is rich, it is massive, it is hype, it is like deeply interesting and profoundly meaningful on a bunch of different levels. And it's just, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you can see it. Like, this is a world that you can live in, or you can visit as a tourist, and you can see the landscape there is awe-inspiring. It's just transcendent.
Couldn't all of that be true, and also everything that I've been saying also be true?
Yes. I mean, if what you're saying is there are even better lands to visit?
Yes. Yeah.
Sure.
That's one way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah, there are even, yes, I agree, But how are we going to get there if we can't start by visiting the ones that exist and recognizing what's beautiful about them? And then,
we made Counter-Strike 20 years ago, or whatever it was.
Well, that's in its favor. That's something that's good about it. That doesn't make it worse.
Here I just make the point that we tend to harp on and focus on a lot what is popular and what works now, which a lot of the times is pretty much similar to what were 10 to 15 to 20 years ago. Whereas I want to talk about what's going to work in the future. Like, how are we going to make things that are way better than the things that we make now? And I don't think it's going to be by embracing stuff that we were doing 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to disagree with you. I mean, I spent my life inventing new kinds of games. I mean, that has always been my instinct. I have always been interested in generating new options and trying out new things and sort of like striking out in new directions. So there's no question that I guess I just maybe this has happened gradually over time. I think I've come to appreciate these other things, these longer term games that have existed in the world, and sort of like come to admire and respect them in a way that I didn't when I was first starting out and kind of like so hungry for novelty. And I still, you know, I'm still hungry for novelty, and I still, that's my main thing that I'm interested in as a designer. But I have, I've come to admire and respect these other qualities a little bit more.
So that concludes this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Sorry about the weird audio stuff and the editing. Hopefully it was pretty listenable. The last episode with Frank got a really good response, and so I hope people enjoy this one too. And we're going to have more guests in the future and more just me yapping into the microphone episodes as well. So stay tuned, and thank you so much for listening. By the way, I think we have hit 25,000 downloads for this episode, for this podcast. So that's pretty cool for a pretty niche type of podcast. And thanks so much to everyone for listening. And we'll have more coming soon. See you next time. This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.